And now,
in the nation's northwest corner,
here he is.
Is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Spinell, who joins us for All Over the Map. A quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. This week, the Port Angeles flood of 1863, which is all too appropriate for what we're seeing out there now.
Isn't that strange timing? So this is up on the Olympic Peninsula. Port Angeles was named by the Spanish Puerto de la Nuestra Señora de los Ángeles, named for the Virgin Mary, Mother of Jesus, Port of Our Lady of the Angels. American settlement didn't begin there until around 1861. The community was called Cherbourg initially. And then the growth of the economy, the population, was really boosted when they got the U.S. Customs House. They wrested it away from Port Townsend. We could spend an hour on that, but we won't. Very lot of political machinations. And a guy named Victor Smith had been appointed by President Lincoln to be the collector of the Customs House. And he sort of got wrested that away from Port Townsend. He had some real estate speculation, of course. In those early years, Port Angeles, the settlement was over on the far west end of what's now the downtown. There was businesses and houses, the Customs House, and a marine hospital, all clustered around Valley Creek. Valley Street is still there now. You'd never know it based on what's there nowadays. But there'd been heavy rain and snow, and everything took a deadly turn on Wednesday, December 16th, 1863. It was an unusual sound that people noticed first. There'd been heavy rain and snow, and the theory is that somewhere up in those hills, Valley Creek had been blocked by trees and other debris, maybe snow and ice, and a lake formed behind the blockage. Then something shifted and the whole thing let loose. A wall of water and mud about 15 feet high rushed down Valley Creek right through the heart of Port Angeles. Victor Smith was out of town, but his wife rescued their four kids. Two workers at the Customs House weren't as lucky. They died and were found in the mud the next day. Many other buildings were destroyed. The damage was spread over an area 100 yards wide and about a mile long. I mean, this was crazy. And there's no photographs. No one had a camera back in what's now Port Angeles back in 1863. And the town then had a population of maybe a few hundred before the flood. Within a year or so, that dwindled to just a few dozen, and the town pretty much faded away for about the next 25 years. Victor Smith died in a shipwreck in 1865. The Customs House was taken back to Port Townsend in 1865, and it wasn't until about 1887, one of those utopian communities that we had around here in those days, they chose Port Angeles as their home, and that's when the town started growing again. That only lasted for a few years, and they were chased out of town, all sorts of weird stuff going on with that, of course. But if not for that flood, Port Angeles might have grown much differently, and it might never have come back if that community hadn't, the utopian community hadn't sited there in the late 1880s. So
the current residents of Port Angeles are descendants of the original utopians?
Maybe a few of them. It could be, yeah. And at Valley Street, where this flood was, I walked up there last month. There's no evidence, no monument, no sense that there was this. The original town was clustered right along that creek that all got washed away about 156 years ago this week.
Wow. Felix Spinell, thank you. A member of the state legislature stands accused of domestic terrorism and may face federal charges as a result. Cairo Radio's Aaron Granillo is here with the latest on the report against Republican Matt Shea. Aaron?
Yeah, Dave, this was an independent report, and it found Shea actually helped to plan the armed takeover of a wildlife refuge in Oregon. You may recall that this six-week standoff ended in 2016 after one protester was shot and killed, dozens of others arrested. A reaction to this report was swift and harsh from Shea's own party. State House Republican leader J.T. Wilcox called on Shea to resign.
He's brought disgrace into his caucus and to the state legislature.
The 108-page report, it was commissioned by the Washington House, and it found Shea, quote, planned, engaged in, and promoted a total of three armed conflicts of political violence against the United States.
He had presented himself as someone who was traveling to these confrontations in order to defuse them. But according to documents written by him and shared by his associates, he had planned the confrontations.
Now, Cairo Radio did reach out but did not hear back from Representative Shea as of yet. But in a Facebook post, he calls this report a sham investigation. He says he will not back down, he will not give in or resign. Republican Representative Jim Walsh spoke with KTTH.
They have not been proven yet, but they are troubling allegations. And we have to respect due process and Matt Shea's rights to defend himself against these allegations.
In the meantime, Shea has been suspended from the House Republican caucus. He will no longer have access to most resources and staff, and he will be removed from all of his committees. That includes as a ranking member of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Republican leader Wilcox says that is just the beginning.
This has now been referred to a federal prosecutor. He has much bigger problems than whether or not he can serve as a state representative.
But again, Shea denies the findings of this report. He claims he never had the opportunity to review or respond before its release either.
So does he deny that he was ever part of this group? Or
we don't have specifics because his response right now doesn't get into the specifics about anything in the details of the report. All he says is that this is right now a sham investigation and he will fight it.
But we know what happened there.
Yeah. We do know what happened.
I mean, if he wasn't involved in any way, if this was a sham, if he had no part in this armed takeover of federal land, he would say so, presumably. But is it not accepted he was a supporter of that group?
He has publicly supported members of this group before, yes. He's admitted that he traveled to these armed takeovers, yes. But all he was saying is that he was trying to just support the group. Now, what the report is saying, though, is he actually was very much so involved in this takeover. The report claims that he actually led some of the military-style operations.
Was he ever armed himself?
The reports does not show that he was ever armed, no. Not in this instance. But, however, he was, according to the report, involved in a previous incident in Idaho, I believe it was, where, he did partake in an armed-style takeover, according to the report. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Aaron Granillo. Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, you got it.
And now, from a planet far, far away, and a website close, close by, here is Tom Tangney with the new Star Wars movie, The Rise of Skywalker. And so you're serious? This is supposed to be the last Star Wars movie?
This is it? This is the last of the original three trilogies. There are three separate trilogies that George Lucas supposedly envisioned when he made the very first Star Wars, which became Star Wars 4 and all of that. That this is the end of his vision.
This is the end of the official George Lucas story.
But believe me, there can be spin-offs. We've already had a number of spin-offs. We've got the Solo, the Han Solo backstory. There'll be plenty of threads to pull from this, but this is seen as the climactic wrap-up of all the stuff. I think the best comparison is to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You know how they did 18 movies and supposedly it all came to an end? Well, Marvel's going to continue, but this kind of storyscape, I think, comes to an end, wraps up, and answers most of the questions you had. So that's the key here. Writer-director J.J. Abrams, who took over for Lucas for this final trilogy, he had an enormous task, Dave, with Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. He had to answer all the questions and tie up all the loose ends left by the previous 8 Star Wars films while still delivering a fast-paced adventure movie that could engage fans and newcomers alike. Now, I think Abrams succeeds in filling in most of the blanks. The story and character holes are all dutifully addressed. But as satisfactory a three-trilogy wrap-up is in terms of narrative, The Rise of Skywalker feels surprisingly slight as a movie experience. As finales go, it has surprisingly little new to offer. It's mostly a retread of very familiar Star Wars plot elements and action sequences, and that's about it. Now, I realize that emotional resonance has never been the calling card of the franchise, but after all this time we've spent with all these characters, shouldn't we feel something a little more powerful than a shrug? We find out in the opening scroll of this 9th film that the evil Emperor Palpatine, who died many movies back, is mysteriously alive again.
What?
And forming a First Order. And I'm not giving too much away because that is literally the first scroll of the movie. It tells us that. So that's what I'm going, wait a minute. They've revived the Palpatine himself. He's mysteriously alive again and forming a First Order military to destroy the Rebel Alliance and the Jedi's once and for all, Dave.
Long have I waited.
Sounds like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I know. It does have that kind of... And you know how Lord of the Rings kept ending and ending and ending in the final finale? It has that kind of... They really drag this out. Now, our heroine, Rey, the scavenger-turned-Jedi in training, reunites with Finn, the stormtrooper-turned-rebel, and Poe, the daredevil rebel fighter pilot, to try to stop Palpatine's destructive plans for the galaxy. Rey's Jedi mentor, Luke Skywalker, may have passed on in the last film, but he's with her in spirit as she takes up arms.
We've passed on all we know. A 1,000 generations live in you now. But this is your fight.
thousand generations.
What is he saying?
A thousand generations of Jedi now live in her, Rey, but it's now your fight. She's been training and training and training in the years since
this
the
one
end of
person.
Lesson. Yeah.
Did they ever explain why the galaxy's future always seems to hinge on just one person?
Yeah. Well, it's not. I mean, the whole Jedi, they're trying to wipe out Jedi. And remember, the last movie was called The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
This it ends up becoming a big battle between the Sith and Jedi one last time. I don't know why that is, Dave. It just makes for better melodrama, okay. Right? Okay. So let me get back to the review. A true multitasker, Rey also has multiple personal confrontations with Kylo Ren, Darth Vader's grandson, and leader of Palpatine's First Order. Ren persists in his quest to lure Rey to be by his side on the dark side, and she fears that temptation. Their battles, interestingly enough, are mostly telepathic, thanks to some kind of mind-meld wavelength they're both on, but eventually, and climactically, they face off in person. In this final war between the First Order and the Resistance, and ultimately between the Sith and the Jedi, our heroic trio of Rey, Finn, and Poe are joined by some very familiar faces like Chewbacca and C-3PO. Even the original Lando Calrissian, 82-year-old Billy Dee Williams, comes back for one last ride, as does General Leia Organa, thanks to some unused and recycled footage of actress Carrie Fisher garnered before she died.
Oh my God.
Other prominent characters reappear as visions or memories as well. Now, this class reunion vibe slows down the film's momentum, but I'm sure fans will appreciate the space trip down memory lane. In a scene in which C-3PO faces the possibility of a memory wipe, Poe catches him looking wistful.
What are you doing there, 3PO?
Taking one last look, sir, at my friends.
That's right. Now that's a nice scene halfway through the movie that should encapsulate what every Star Wars fan could be feeling as The Rise of Skywalker ends. Pure and gratifying nostalgia, along with a bit of regret and a sense of loss that the entire Enterprise is over. But poignancy is beyond the reach of The Rise of Skywalker. Unlike the two-film finale of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Avengers Infinity War and Avengers Endgame, which packed an emotional wallop amidst all the mayhem, Star Wars ends not with a bang, but with a ho-hum.
Hmm. So I thought it was supposed to answer all the questions. So do we find out what the Force actually is?
No, I mean, not explicitly.
We don't. Do we find out?
I'll tell you one thing. The Force is always with us.
I know that.
It binds the universe together.
Yeah, like the Higgs boson. Do they ever explain why the galaxy needs to be destroyed?
No,
I mean, what do you gain by that?
Yep.
Even if you're a bad guy, do they explain? Chewbacca an endorsement of chewing tobacco or not?
Those are not the questions they're addressing. It's like, who are Rey's parents?
Oh, geez.
That we want to know. The parentage issue. What is Kylo Ren's relationship with Rey? I'm not going to tell you anything.
No,
you got to
go
see the movie. And believe me, everybody and his mother will see this movie.
How many tangs?
Well, I think just strictly as a movie, it's 2.5 out of 4. But if you're a Star Wars fan, and who isn't, it's probably a 3 for the experience.
Okay.
But I wanted it to be a 4.
Well, 2.5. That's all you get.
There you go.
Thank you, Tom.
And time for your daily dose of kindness. 3 little words taken separately. Each word with just one syllable doesn't mean a lot. But when you say them together, they speak volumes and they open your heart. At least they do for one woman in North London, England. No, not those 3 words. These 3 words. Mind the gap. If you have ever taken the tube in London, that's the city subway system, you have seen Mind the Gap written on the platform and heard it spoken over the loudspeaker system. The phrase tells you to watch your step between the platform and the train. But for Dr. Margaret McCollum, it is more than a safety announcement. That is because Mind the Gap were the words spoken by her husband, Oswald Lawrence, more than 40 years ago when he recorded that famous announcement for Transport London. Lawrence passed away about 5 years ago. The underground system started replacing those announcements, except for one station, the Embankment Station, which kept Lawrence on the loudspeaker. That did provide some comfort to the grieving widow. She says she would often go to the Embankment Station just to hear her husband and make it sound like he was still with her. But one day she noticed something different. a new announcement at embankments. A new voice said, "Mind the gap, please." Well, she reached out to the agency and told them how much it meant to her to hear her husband's voice. And a compassionate employee listened. So from here on in, the new voice, which politely says please at the end, has been scrapped. And the voice of Oswald Lawrence has returned at the embankment station only. All for the widow who just can't believe, if for just a few seconds as a noisy train approaches, that her husband lives on. Oh, and the Transport London has also given Margaret a CD of the announcement in case she can't make it to the station.
Well, that's a very considerate thing to do. Seattle's Morning News, good to have you tuned in today. Rachel Bell sat down with a family who's getting ready to celebrate Hanukkah, but it turns out their story has a bit of an unusual twist.
Hanukkah begins Sunday night at sundown. And just like many Jewish people, Kent's Mandolin Carlson and her family will be lighting their menorah for 8 nights. But there is a pretty big difference between Mandolin and those Jewish people.
We're not Jewish. I get that question a lot.
So why is a non-Jewish family with no Jewish people in their lives celebrating Hanukkah? For the Carlsons, it started in 2013, when Hanukkah happened to fall on Thanksgiving. Mandolin came across an article about having gratitude-themed conversations on every night of Hanukkah, and she thought it was a really nice idea. So she decided to try something new with her husband and two small children.
I didn't have a menorah, so I got 9 little candles, and each night we would light them, and we would think about the theme that we had for the night. Like one night it was family, and then other nights we talked about what it meant to have friends in our lives.
Mandolin says the candle lighting ritual brought a rare peacefulness and calm into their home during a busy time of year.
I was asking my son, I said, "What do you like about it?" He goes, "I like it when we turn all the lights off and we just watch the candles." And they will sit there and they'll watch the candles for like a good 20 minutes.
The Carlsons celebrate Hanukkah their own way. They don't say the traditional prayers when they light the candles.
I don't speak Hebrew. There's also the issue of we're not religious at all. Like, we don't believe in God. So praying seems not natural to us.
Instead, they read children's Hanukkah books and discuss the story of Hanukkah.
I do worry that Jewish people are people who celebrate Hanukkah as part of their religion, that they might be offended that we celebrate Hanukkah in such a haphazard, flippant way. But I hope they're not, because I do plan on talking more about the culture of that goes along with Hanukkah and the struggles that the Jewish people have had in the past and today. But it's just not the right time for my kid right now.
Now, I wouldn't go so far to say that what Mandolin's family is doing is a trend, but there are other non-Jews out there who light Hanukkah candles. I've heard about a kid coming home from preschool and learning about Hanukkah at school and wanting to do it at home. So the question is this okay? Is it cultural appropriation? Is it disrespectful to celebrate a Jewish holiday if you're not Jewish? I reached out to Rabbi Sydney Danziger. She's the rabbi at B'nai Torah in Bellevue.
Make Jewish friends and go to their home and watch them light the menorah rather than have one in your own. I think we've become so sensitive in a good way to sort of this cultural appropriation.
Katie Stern has a master's degree in interfaith dialogue. She's also a Christian and the director of administration at B'nai Torah.
I would say call up your local synagogue and go to their Hanukkah latke dinner. Every Jewish community I've seen in Seattle has one going on. And the reality is like, okay, if you want to have a menorah at home, great, but don't light it until you've gone to a Jewish community, invested in that Jewish community, and shown the proper respect to learn from them and to listen to them and to be a participant and a witness and a learner. That would be my biggest encouragement. Go spend the money, go have a latke dinner, eat really good food, and learn from beautiful rabbis who are doing incredible work in the community.
I want to know what you think. Let us know. You can text the listener line at 98973.
Yeah. I should point out that Christians lost complete control over Christmas a long time ago.
Yeah.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.